Welcome to Season 6 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're continuing our journey of broadening our knowledge in the field of combat sports science by speaking to experts in the fields of nutrition science, psychology, strength and conditioning, and much more to help you become the best practitioner you can be. Today, our guest on the podcast is yet again our good friend, Mark Germain. Mark is a performance nutritionist and alumni of prestigious Liverpool John Moores University in Liverpool, England. Mark returns to the podcast to give us a balanced and scientific overview of something that is rapidly flooding all of our social media feeds, CBD. You do not have to look far to see athletes, businessmen, influencers, and everyday folk touting the benefits of CBD in its many forms. But where are we really at with the science of it? Mark has given many presentations about this very topic, so in this episode, we are going to discuss exactly what the research currently says and get his thoughts on what the future holds for this popular substance. There's a lot of cool info in this episode, so let's get to it. Green light means we are live, so back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Season 6, what a season it's been so far, and I think it's only right that we bring back one of the originals of the Fight Science Podcast. Mark, actually, you kicked off the Fight Science Podcast a couple of years ago, very first episode, breaking down the science of fight camp nutrition. Everyone, welcome Mark Germain. Mark, thanks for coming on, mate.
It's a pleasure to be asked on, Jordan. Every time I get asked on, I'm always happy to kind of contribute, and it's always a joy to be on.
No, it's good getting you guys on. I think we've got a good little community, good little group here where we're all kind of bouncing ideas off. And man, it's crazy. I actually went through all the downloads and everything the other day. I've never really looked at it. And then, because I was tossing up, I was like, do I do it another season or do I do this other project that I want? And I went, oh, well, you know what? Like, I probably should keep this going. There seems to be a lot of people that are following it. So, man, it's been good, but it's come a long way since then. And what's been happening with you? What's been going on? I feel like we haven't spoken in, what, 6 months or so? Probably a bit more?
Yeah, it was probably last June or so, probably would have been. During the first lockdown. We're in our third advent of lockdown in Ireland now, so I don't know what it is in Australia or how many series you've had. But I think, yeah, we're in our third version now. Hopefully coming onto the greener side, you know, no pun intended, Ireland. The way, you know, vaccines are going up and we're back. Sports are back. Well, I say sports. Professional sports are back here in Ireland, and GEA, which I also work in, is back on Monday the 19th. So today's Tuesday. So next Monday we're back. So then hopefully from there research can pick up as well, so we can start doing a little bit more applied research. You know, we've got one study which we're just about to start with John. So, you know, I don't know if you had John on before with hot bats.
Yep. We did. Yeah, I saw he released his second paper.
Yeah, so the second paper was kind of like a small follow-up on the first study where they kind of just let the athletes pick their own temperature, whereas this time we're going to essentially increase the concentration of salt, so more towards seawater levels, because, you know, that's where they do like deep sea diving. You might see some stuff in the literature there. So we're going to really increase the concentration of the salt to see if that has anything. And we're also going to include a couple of more tests. You know, we're going to do some bloods, and we're also then going to include the UFC performance battery tests. So then we have a performance measurement at the end of the test as well. So this is what their baseline is. They're cutting this amount of weight. This is what the performance tests say after they cut the weight. So it's be a little bit more kind of a bigger picture version. And hopefully it kind of sheds a little bit more light on, you know, the whole concept of hot baths. You know, does salt do anything, even if you have, like, if the amount of salt that we'll be using, it'll be way more than people are using in practice, for example. So the ones that we did that John has done in the previous ones would have been the amount of salt that people have been using in practice, whereas now we're kind of like pushing more towards the theoretical boundary of, you know, osmosis. You see, if water moves, so we're kind of pushing that up. So hopefully then in the next couple of weeks we can actually get that started. We're just waiting for one piece of equipment. It's actually really annoying. This is the joy of the stuff behind research that you don't see. I've been trying to set up a supplier for just some strips for an Abbott medical device. And I've been trying since before Christmas to get them set up so I can actually order the product. And their customer service has not been great. That's all I'll say. Like, it's been very slow.
There you go. If you're listening to this, Abbott, then pick up your game, yeah, sort your stuff out. But isn't it crazy, eh, Mark, that I remember the first time I spoke to John, and I always reference his work, because like, especially if you do seminars or even just when you're coaching athletes and doing consults, they always talk about that. It's a question they always ask. Do I put in the Epsom salts? How long? And I always step back and, yeah, regardless if the salts do anything or not, and I always step back and think, like, how cool is it that we're at the point of research where we're looking at that, where combat sports and making weight and weight cutting is at the point where we can start nitpicking that process, and we can start nitpicking the bathing process. Okay, is there a better bathing process that leads to better performance? Is there an ideal protocol that's safer for the athletes, because they're going to do it regardless? So it's really, really cool to see.
Yeah, it's good. And I suppose, I don't know if this was written in the paper or not, but anecdotally from John's BAT study, the athletes tended to report, you know, they were blinded whether I had salt or not, but they were asked basically how hot it felt. This was when the temperature was like kept consistent at 37.8. And anecdotally, whenever they were in the salt condition, they said that it felt, you know, cooler essentially. So it didn't quite feel as hot. So, you know, it may not be an insignificant finding in practice for some people if it feels a little bit easier, even though you get the same like weight loss with and without salt. If someone kind of psychologically feels a little bit better with it in it, then you're kind of not losing much, and it's a little bit of a win for the athlete and a little bit of a win for you when you're sitting on the side, and it's, you know, the process goes a little bit smoother.
Yeah, yeah, spot on. Hey, I actually had a gentleman message me the other night about doing his masters, and he's looking at heat acclimation or something, and that was a point that I was getting across to him. It's like, man, like, there could very well be performance benefits to it, and it'd be cool to see studies, but I'm going to bet my bottom dollar that what you're going to find is psychological. And then he was kind of like, oh, well, I don't know how significant that is. And when you do it in practice or you do it yourself, you realize it is significant. That little psychological push or that psychological difference, it is significant, especially with these guys when they're doing it, you know, professional level, you get to elite level, you get to the UFC, it makes a massive difference.
Yeah. And you want to make it easy as possible, because despite the amount that a lot of people cut weight, it's not often that people actually enjoy the process. You know, you'll often have people who are coming to you for help because they're sick and tired of having to cut so much, you know, through pure dehydration. So that's kind of, if you can make the whole process easier, that's what are coming to you. And it's like psychologically, it's probably how you perceive something is all kind of psychological. And if you can do something physiologically, then to reduce that psychological burden, well, that's a huge win for the athlete. And then that becomes a win for you as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But the reason I got you on, Mark, is because I wanted to chat to you, and you've done a lot of work in this area of late, and you're kind of my go-to scientific advisor for all things science when it comes to sports and athletics. So I want to talk to you about CBD, because everywhere you look in not just the athletic populations, general populations, CBD is everywhere. I don't know what it's like in Ireland, but it's definitely popping up everywhere across Australia, New Zealand. I was just in the States, and it is quite literally everywhere. Every type of product you can think of, like rubs, gummies, you know, vapes, everything. There's CBD everywhere you look. I want to talk to you about it and talk to you, what is the relationship in the literature with it, you know, in regards to athletic performance, recovery, et cetera, et cetera. Let's get into it. Let's just start with a basic, what is CBD, Mark?
Yeah, so CBD is a cannabinoid, and it's found in essentially cannabis plant. And typically what they'll do is they'll get hemp plants and extract CBD from it. So it's cannabis oil. Now you have like two main cannabinoids, or the two biggest cannabinoids are most frequently found is THC and CBD. When people think about like smoking cannabis or having some sort of cannabis edibles, for example, THC is kind of the psychoactive compound that gives you the kind of high, whereas CBD almost has like the counter effect. And what I mean by that is that CBD, when someone has cannabis, like if you ever hear from the medical side, one of the concerns is kind of like psychosis, or people get like really anxious, to get kind of psychotic, nervous, that type of stuff. Where CBD seems to have an effect where it can actually reduce anxiety. So it's kind of counters that effect. And it does that by actually like binding to a receptor. It binds to one of the receptors that kind of like turns down the effect. So if you think about like a dial, like a dimmable switch for a light, it kind of turns down that kind of effect of THC when it comes to psychosis. And in that regard, like there are some kind of like medical studies going on in London at the moment where they're actually comparing different ratios of THC to CBD in like cannabis to see, to try to formulate better medicinal cannabis. So there might be some medicinal benefits to cannabis itself. And if we kind of counter some of those kind of more negative effects that we see with THC with increases in CBD content, then you might get like a better medical product. So that's essentially what CBD is. And probably one of the reasons why it kind of exploded in the last couple of years. So it's probably one is that in 2018, WADA, so the World Anti-Doping Agency, they removed CBD from the doping list. So you can actually have CBD in the system. Now, THC is still on the doping list, and they didn't remove any of the other cannabinoids. And it's just worth noting that, you know, there's about 144 cannabinoids. All the other ones are kind of like in smaller quantities, but there is still all those other cannabinoids, and they are still on the World Anti-Doping Prohibited List, except with a couple of exceptions. I know the UFC recently have taken cannabis off, and I think the NBA have as well. So that might be coming, that might have something to do with the laws in the USA, because I know like some states are just legalizing cannabis. And so you might see that shift, more of a shift in the USA towards, you know, all of this being off the prohibited list. But like that kind of WADA kind of thing kickstarted the use of or the promotion of CBD in sports, because, you know, if it was, I suppose the thought for some people is that if it was on the prohibited list, it must do something. And now that it's off the prohibited list, well, now we can take it to do whatever it was stopping us from doing in the first place. And then that's probably not a great way to look at it. It's probably just on the prohibited list because, you know, cannabis was classed as illegal in a lot of countries. It was like an illegal drug. So it's like cocaine. You can't be having like illegal drugs during competition. As laws soften, that could change. But yeah, you would have seen CBD products now, if they have less than 0.3% THC, that's typically what it is in the EU. If you have less than 0.3% THC, they can sell CBD products in the store. So I suppose that's kind of what like CBD is in a nutshell. And we'll probably go into what some of the claims might be and, you know, what is the evidence around some of those claims at the moment.
Yeah, let's dive into that, because as you're saying that, I'm just thinking of a lot of the athletes that I work with, and I feel like every week one of my athletes, there's a new CBD sponsor that's on board, whether they're promoting the oil, whether they're promoting the gummies. It just seems like everyone is jumping on that. And of course, athletes who are getting given free stuff obviously might exacerbate claims and whatnot. But talk to us. What does the evidence say? What does the evidence say about these claims? Because you always hear athletes and they're talking. They got their gummies, they got their oils, and they're talking about the benefits of sleep and the benefits of recovery. You and I are scientists. We need the evidence. Show us some data. What does the data say, Mark?
Yeah, I suppose there's a couple of different claims around CBD. I'll start with the claims. So probably some of the more common ones that you'll see is like sleep, for example. So people are saying like, oh, I'm taking CBD before bed, it helps sleep. So sleep is kind of one area where we do have some research in CBD. So you'd have like case studies from like the 1980s, for example, where people were taking CBD, they followed them over time, and there was like some people who were reporting like less vivid dreams and better sleep. Now it's worth noting that these are all kind of like self-reported at the time. And we follow this up like 20, 30 years later, now that the research is starting to come out, see that, again, it depends on what form. If you're taking like a spray, there's some, you can get like products, most commonly actually about 5 milligrams of what people are going to be, 4 to 5 milligrams of what people are going to be taking in drops, for example. So people are, if you take like a 5 to 15 milligram spray, there's some research showing that CBD actually promotes wakefulness. And they used this in people who had like a chronic tired condition. So they used this to treat people who were kind of chronically tired. They'd use CBD in the morning and it would actually promote wakefulness. So that wouldn't really align with the kind of previous research, but it was still not great evidence. What we have seen though, there's a group in Brazil. There's two guys in particular, Kikuno Pazurdos and Linares. And they've been doing research in the area of CBD since like 1980s. And it's kind of, they're kind of accelerating in the last couple of years. And they did a really good study on sleep in that the gold standard when we measure sleep is called polysomnography. And that basically means that you go into the lab, you get all these electrodes hooked up to you, so they're measuring brain activity, they're measuring breathing rate, they're measuring the kind of stages of sleep, like in properly, not like a like an app would. And they gave people 300 milligrams of CBD. So if you're thinking about a bottle of CBD, that's about one third of a bottle. Like a bottle of CBD is about 1,000 milligrams typically. So they gave people a 300 milligrams of CBD going to bed compared to like placebo. And they actually showed no effect on sleep architecture. So no difference in the sleep stages, no difference in sleep time or time to go to sleep. So that's probably the best evidence that we have at the moment that, you know, if there is an effect, it doesn't seem to be a big effect anyway, because that's probably the best study we have in the area of sleep for CBD. So I'm not convinced on the sleep claims. Like I know if people like have cannabis, like that makes you feel, you know, tired, you know, anyone who has done before. But that's kind of like coming back to the differences between cannabis and CBD. CBD isn't cannabis because it hasn't got all of those other cannabinoids in there, and particularly THC. So it's like, I know like it's very easy to kind of think CBD automatically kind of has the same effects as cannabis, but without the kind of high feeling. But it's not quite like that. We have got about three studies specifically in sport. One of them was quite a poorly conducted study, I think it last summer, looking at kind of muscle damage, and they showed it was published in an obscure journal, which is always kind of like a warning flag. I've never heard of the journal before, and they kind of like showed that there might have been some benefit in terms of training. Then we've had two other kind of more well-conducted studies in CBD and sport. So one was a survey study, and it was basically done in rugby union and rugby league. And what they showed in this kind of survey study was that, you know, there was 517 athletes across rugby. And rugby would be a sport now where if there is going to be an effect, a lot like fighting, you know, you're getting beat up in fighting, they're getting beat up in rugby. You often need to take painkillers after fighting. People are often taking painkillers after rugby, particularly with the alcohol bans now. Because once alcohol bans came into like rugby after games, they're kind of alcohol kind of numbed the pain after the game. Now they're kind of switching to find something else to numb the pain. So it's like, all right, if this CBD, like athletes are going to be like, if this does anything, I'll take it, you know, to try to get me off like taking prescription painkillers all the time. So they looked at CBD use in about 517 rugby athletes. And they found that like 26% like either currently use or had previously used CBD products, which is, you know, 1 in 4, which is a high enough percent considering the kind of status of CBD at the moment. And 80% of people were taking it for improving recovery or pain. And 78% were taking it for sleep. So in and all around this kind of sleep and recovery and pain management. And then 68% actually found that, you know, they had a perceived benefit from it. So athletes are taking CBD, they're taking it for recovery, pain, sleep, and they're perceiving a benefit from it. So as I was kind of saying, like with sleep, it doesn't seem to be so much, but if there is kind of some evidence in the other areas, it would be benefit. And the second study then that in a kind of athletic population, training population, they actually looked at kind of exercise-induced muscle damage. And while you do see like reductions in pain and inflammation in rodent literature, so I'll say this, like in the animal literature, what they do is they give them CBD to try to reduce inflammation and pain. But the model that they use is that they inject them to give them collagen-induced arthritis. So they inject these rodents to give them like a really high inflammatory state. And then they give them CBD at a dose of 10 milligrams per kilogram. Now, if you're thinking about an athlete, say maybe 80 kilograms, 10 milligrams per kg. Now, I know it doesn't convert straight like from rodents to animals. You've heard to do some more complex calculations. But if you just take it on face value, kind of simple arithmetic, that's about 800 milligrams. I remember I said earlier on that your typical drop in a tincture is about 4 milligrams and the whole bottle is about 1,000 milligrams. So the dose is being used in these animal studies. So one, it's a real it's a different model to exercise-induced muscle damage where you're giving someone arthritis. And two, the doses that they're being used in this. And we kind of saw that play out in the human study whereby they gave did exercise-induced muscle damage session, and then they measured pain just on a visual analog scale. So soreness went up as you'd expect after doing some sort of exercise-inducing muscle damage session. But there was no difference between giving them CBD, which he, I think he used tinctures and that, so oil drops, and there was no difference between placebo. And then they measured performance as well. So they measured all these performance benefits. And again, no difference between giving someone CBD or giving someone placebo. So in the area of kind of like muscle damage, muscle recovery, pain. But now it's worth noting that the pain exhibited from exercise-induced muscle damage might not necessarily be the same as pain that you get from being beat up in a rugby match or a fight. You know, it's hard to replicate that level of you know, fatigue and damage. That's what I'm saying, like, how we were actually discussing, because I've done one of these muscle damage studies myself, and you know, the model that we're using to do these muscle damage studies, it's just not really practical, because you're doing like lots of eccentrics in a drop jump. But really what we need to be doing is we need to be doing something which, you know, damages the muscle and causes like glycogen reduction, you know, and has lots of sprints in it and decelerations. We need to be using these kind of multi-factor muscle damage, fatigue inducing battery of tests, essentially, if you want to try replicate what's happening in a match or in a fight, because I don't think our simple models of, you know, let's do 100 drop jumps is really good enough. But that's probably on a kind of a different line. But when we look at CBD in this kind of pain, sleep, we said sleep, there's not great literature there, doesn't seem to be doing anything. Again, we only have one study, and this will start growing in the next couple of years. So there's a guy at Liverpool John Moores University. It's called Scott Gillam. He's doing his PhD in the area of CBD under Graham Close, and they've started doing cell work now. So it might be similar to Daniel Owen's vitamin D work, where they have cells, they'll scrape them, they'll like kind of bathe them in CBD compared to placebo, and see if the CBD is present, does it actually accelerate the kind of muscle regeneration process. So his PhD will be very good, and it will probably give us an awful lot more information that we currently have. And then Lewis James also has a PhD student working on CBD as well. So we will get better research in the coming years, but particularly as it relates to muscle damage at the moment, it doesn't have a whole lot of promise. And I suppose like one of the other areas then that you have, I kind of touched on it when I was talking about the difference between CBD and THC, is probably maybe sports performance anxiety. So athletes might get really anxious before a competition, particularly if you're kind of younger. It might be your first event, it might be your first fight on UFC, it might be your first event in the octagon or something to that effect. And anxiety is something which is like pretty common. How much is good and how much is bad? You know, you have all the psychological models which kind of are out in my area. But anxiety is actually one area where CBD does actually seem to have an effect. And the majority of the research comes from this group in Brazil again. And they've been doing a decent, they have a couple of studies now. They have at least 3 or 4 studies looking at this. And they consistently seem to find an effect of CBD on anxiety. And the model they use when they're looking at this in terms of anxiety is they basically put people on stage to do a talk. You know, and if anyone has ever like presented at a conference, it is pretty anxious, you know, particularly if you've never done it before, you know, your heart is racing, you're going to go up, you're going to make an idiot of yourself potentially. So it's a stressful event. So it's a decent model to probably induce anxiety. And they actually found kind of an inverted U dose response. So what by that, I mean that they give them 150 milligrams of CBD and, you know, it reduces anxiety. They give them 300 milligrams of CBD, it reduces anxiety even more. But if you give them 600 milligrams of CBD, it drops back down to about 150 milligrams, so you're going to get this inverted U dose response. And in that type of model, it does seem to kind of help with CBD. So I suppose of the kind of three areas where there might be some promise, you've kind of got anxiety, where it does seem to help, sleep, where it kind of suspect whether it does help, and exercise induced muscle damage, where we definitely need more research. And that might come around looking at different forms of CBD, because like you were saying, you've got edibles, you've got tinctures, you've got oils, you've got sprays, you've got pills, you've got capsules, and these all could have very different effects because they all have different pharmacokinetics and how they actually get into the system.
Yeah, that's a good point and a good segue into what I want to ask you next, because you and I, coming from science backgrounds, very mechanistic. I'm very mechanistic whenever I think about this. When we talk about supplements, it's like, okay, how does it work? Like, break it down for me, you know, from paper to podium, that kind of concept. Can you kind of talk to us about the endocannabinoid system? How does this interrelate? And what's the theory behind how these CBD oils, tinctures, whatever, like how are the cannabinoids making an effect in the body theoretically?
Yeah, so you have, we do, everyone has an endocannabinoid system, and that will kind of ongo even whether you're kind of taking cannabinoid systems or not. And this does kind of regulate kind of inflammation, pain, and these other areas of the body. There's lots of cell work in this area as well, where they're actually examining, you know, ex vivo, taking this stuff, looking at the CBD system and how it actually impacts. So it can impact on inflammation, pain, particularly you've got two main receptors, kind of CB receptor 1 and CB receptor 2. So THC binds to CB receptor 1, and that's what kind of, it's an agonist, so it kind of heightens the effects of kind of whatever kind of CB1 kind of binds to. CBD was thought to only bind to CB2 receptor, and that's why it might have kind of different effects, but now we kind of think that CBD actually binds to CB1 receptor, and that's where we're saying where it acts as like a negative allosteric regulator. So that's how it kind of turns down the effects of the system. So the thinking behind CBD supplementation is that you supplement with this CBD, it binds to the CB receptor in the endocannabinoid system, and then that should kind of amplify, well, you know, the thought process is amplify the effects of the endocannabinoid system, and that can go from, you know, like in the brain where it's quite active to even like you have CB receptors all over the body and taste the muscle and organs. So the thought process is that if it binds to these receptors, if it does amplify the response of the endocannabinoid system, then it should reduce pain, reduce inflammation. And then there is also some kind of, again, cell work. There might be one animal study as well, even looking at the effects in terms of concussion, because the endocannabinoid system can be quite, if you're just looking at the endocannabinoid system, it can play a role in kind of cognition and in brain. So they've actually done I'm nearly sure they've done a model in rodents at the moment, so on mice, where they've kind of given people a concussion. And again, given a high dose of CBD, and you can see kind of the endocannabinoid system working to reduce some markers of inflammation in around, you know, concussion-related symptoms. So now I suppose the warning with that would be is that, you know, just because your body does something doesn't mean that you kind of supplementing with like CBD is necessarily going to cause that amplification of the system. You know, we might have, it's like if you take something, if you're, say like you have like testosterone of like just like an arbitrary unit of 500, if you take something that boosts it up to 550, probably not going to see an effect in the body. It's only when you go to like super physiological doses. So if people are taking these small doses of CBD, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to amplify that CBD system. It's like just because something that happens. And another example might be better actually, just thinking about growth hormone. If you're deficient in something like growth hormone, you see, you know, like Messi or something, he had to take growth hormone when he was a kid. If you're deficient in growth hormone, it's a problem. If you have like sufficient growth hormone, if you're just injecting someone with growth hormone, there doesn't seem to be that additional benefit. So these are all kind of questions that we still have with regard to CBD. And I suppose like it's probably worth noting that the different forms of CBD could potentially have different effects. And what that I mean is that, so if you take the studies in Brazil that use 300 milligrams, they're taking it in a capsule form, so in a pill. And CBD, a little bit like caffeine, it has to go through first pass metabolism. And the same kind of enzyme family that breaks down caffeine breaks down CBD. So it's the kind of like your cytochrome P450. If people have ever seen like caffeine studies where they're looking at caffeine genes, it's kind of looking at that enzyme. So how that enzyme actually breaks down caffeine, or in this case, CBD. And it does that because like it's lipophilic. So that means it's kind of like fat-liking. And if you want to excrete something through the kidneys, you basically have to make it, you know, water loving, like lipophobic. So you just do that by adding on, basically it's called like a hydroxy group. It makes it water soluble, so it can go into the blood, be excreted in the urine. And that's how, when we test for drugs, we're never testing for what we put into the body. We're testing for whatever the body breaks it down into. So if you're taking a pill, it goes through kind of your liver first, and it's going to go through that first, it's called first pass metabolism. So it's going to start that kind of breaking down process. if you were to take something like a spray, or, you know, a nasal spray or a tincture or drop that you put under the tongue, the thought process there is that, we see this with caffeine as well, is that you kind of bypass that first fast metabolism and it gets into the bloodstream a little bit quicker. So you're getting into the blood quicker, and you should also get kind of more bang for your buck. So if you put 300 milligrams into a capsule, probably not all of that is going to turn up into peak blood levels. Whereas if you put like 10 or 15 milligrams into a spray, more of that should show in the blood because you're skipping that first pass metabolism. So it's just something to consider then. If you are trying to compare these studies where one's doing 300 milligrams and one's doing, 15 milligrams, we really need to look at pharmacokinetic studies to see, what are the effects when these are turning up in the blood. And, if you're consuming with food, for example, there's one study on CBD capsules. And if you take it fasted and if you have it fed, you get a five-fold increase in the amount of CBD that turns up in the blood if you're in a fed state. So there are all these kind of like factors to consider when we're looking at these CBD studies. So I'm kind of looking at these anxiety studies and sleep studies and thinking, if they're in the fasted state, could we get away with, one-fifth of 300 milligrams, like so 60 milligrams, to try get the desired effect? Because at the moment, CBD is not a cheap supplement. And if you're telling someone to take 300 milligrams to like reduce anxiety, for most people, maybe like if they're like really high-end professional athlete, you don't mind spending that much, like every time you're performing or anything like that. But for your average person, your average fighter, it's probably not going to be a cost to benefit ratio there. Whereas if we can kind of reduce that down to 60 milligrams of food, that's a little bit better. And then if we can reduce that further by giving like a nasal spray or a drop where you're kind of bypassing that metabolism, it's getting into the system a little bit quicker. Well, then that can be, again, we're kind of reducing the dose needed. So that's where I think we need a lot of research at the moment, is kind of just doing really the basic research of pharmacokinetics. How much do you need? How much turns up? How much of it actually gets into the blood? And then how can we start then getting cost-effective doses for the athlete?
One thing I do want to ask you, Mark, and let me know if this is in your scope or out of it, but what are the regulations, or what are, at least in the UK, in the EU where you are, is it regulated? Are the doses regulated? The types of cannabinoids that are used in the oils or tinctures or gummies or whatever, is it regulated, or is it kind of like a free-for-all at the moment?
Yeah, so I know there's one study in the US where they actually measured the amount of CBD and THC in the products, and because you can get like full spectrum and isolate. So typically what we're interested in is isolate CBD, because you're isolating just the CBD. With full spectrum CBD, it has all of the other cannabinoids in there. Now that's fine if you're not competing in a tested sport, because as long as it doesn't have the amount of THC, below 0.3%, then it's kind of legal. But for an athlete, if you're taking full spectrum CBD, even though it's fine to purchase, it's probably going to have, it has all the other cannabinoids in it, which aren't off the prohibited list. And you have a higher risk probably of full spectrum CBD that you're going to have, a higher amount of THC in the actual product. So there was a study in the US, for example, and only 15% of commercially available CBD products were actually below the 0.3% maximum limit when they tested them. So it's like they're putting stuff on the label, and it's not exactly rigorous. And you see that across other supplements. Like melatonin is another one where it's pretty popular, where they market it as something and you get like 100% variation in how much melatonin is in the product. And because we have no tested products for athletes at the moment, there's no kind of safe tested products that says this is actually free from consumption, then it's kind of like there's no way that we can kind of give it to athletes and be sure that this product that we're giving them is actually safe for use. And then there's also the issue of, even if there's less than kind of 0.3% THC, how often are they taking the supplement? Because if you're taking it for a prolonged period of time, does that THC accrue over time? And there was another study as well where they looked at this with 4 weeks of supplementation of CBD, and they were giving them 30 milligrams per day. So there should have been less than 1 milligram of THC in the supplement, which there was when they measured this. But the THC metabolite was still present in 50% of participants after those 4 weeks. So in 50% of people, even though you're taking kind of a relatively, like, you know, quote unquote TH-free supplement, if you take that every day, you know, over a period of time, there is that risk that THC metabolites will start showing up in the blood and potentially at concentrations which are, you know, causing anti-doping violation. So there's a, even though it is kind of okay to purchase CBD products in the EU, it's sold as a novel food at the moment. For the time being, we'll see how that progresses. If you're an athlete, just be conscious of there are significant doping risks. And probably, I would say, for anyone who I work with anyway, I say the doping risks are probably too large at the moment to justify consuming CBD based on the evidence that we have at the moment. Because the evidence, you know, around sleep, around recovery, it just isn't, the evidence isn't really there. It's not like it's a super supplement where you're getting these huge benefits and athletes are like, oh, well, I'm willing to risk it. Even even against your advice, I'd say, you know, the benefits aren't really there to even be worth merit risking taking something like that at the moment, just because, you know, just the risks there.
Are there other risks, whether it be health, performance, that outside of what we just spoke about, is there a risk that people are taking that they can say take too much and there'd be adverse effects of taking CBD?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything in the literature of CBD, taking too much CBD. Now, there was one study that went up to even 6,000 milligrams, which is a huge dose, and they didn't find anything. That was in the kind of like pharmacokinetic study when they're looking at. They looked at like varying different doses from like a couple of hundred milligrams, 1,500 milligrams, all the way up to 6,000 milligrams. Now, it's worth noting that was an acute study, so you don't know what happens over time. But there could well be, kind of, like I said, because this is being processed through the liver, you know, maybe if you took high dose CBD over a prolonged period of time, you might get some sort of symptoms in the liver. Like, for example, like, this is an extreme example, just, you know, I'm not comparing the two of them. But it's like anabolic steroids, for example, when you're taking, you know, these type of drugs, essentially, and they're being processed through the liver to try to excrete them, then maybe you could get some sort of damage over time. But I wouldn't say that with any degree of certainty, because if you always think about the 3 days. So it's drug, dose, duration. So like, what's the drug? What's the dose you're taking and how long are you taking for? And it's typically those three in combination which is going to determine if there is any adverse health effects, because, you know, anything in a large enough dose over a long enough period of time can potentially be harmful, you know, even water. So if you take too much water in too short a period of time, that could be harmful. So it depends on, you know, what you're putting in the body, how much of it you're putting in the body, and, you know, how long you're actually doing it for or in what period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm conscious of your time, Mark, so I won't keep you for too much more. But what I'm hearing you talking about this and recapping what science we do have, is it safe to say that we're fairly limited in the claims that we can make with CBD due to the studies available and the study design of those available studies?
Yeah. So even by law in the UK and Ireland, to sell CBD, you're not allowed to put any claims on the label, just because there's not enough research to actually justify any of those claims. So you can sell CBD, for example, in the UK, in Ireland, in the EU, but you can't put on the bottle that it's going to help with kind of inflammation, or it's going to help with pain, or it's going to help with recovery, or any of that stuff. So I'd say, like, there's reason to do research going forwards, but at the moment there's no research to support any of those claims which you might see in the media or in the companies promoting the supplements itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Last question, Mark. Let's say in an ideal world, money wasn't an issue. You would run whatever studies, whatever research you wanted. Say you get dumped millions and millions of dollars and access to all types of cannabis to extract all types of CBD. What type of studies would you be running?
In CBD?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd have to start with some sort of like pharmacokinetic study where we'd actually, because like I kind of feel like at the moment with the doses of CBD that we're using and the types of CBD that we're using, it feels a little bit like we're throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks. So I kind of feel like we need to, you know, do a study with loads of participants. And, you know, over different days, give them different types of CBD. And so I mean like oils, drops, sprays, pills, and at different doses. And then we can start seeing, you know, how it actually appears in the blood. What are the pharmacokinetics of different forms of CBD? And then once we know the pharmacokinetics, well, then that can then inform what doses we can use in various studies. So then we can go into our kind of muscle damage studies. Then we can go into our kind of, you know, sleep studies and pain studies and so on. But I feel like we're kind of missing just that first step where, you know, there's some studies where they're doing research, they're giving 4 milligrams per kg that they're getting in, or 4 milligrams just, I think, just what to get in the drop. And it's like, you know, what's the justification for giving that? Oh, well, it's what the supplement company are selling it as. So it's almost like the research is being led by, you know, supplement companies. Whereas if we look at the previous research in CBD, and even I probably should note that there is actually a medical available CBD supplement called like Epidolex, and it's used for epilepsy, for example, in children with Dravet syndrome. And you know, that's even like you're going up around 100, 200, 300 milligrams CBD there. So like, I don't know why we're using kind of, we're going being guided by supplement companies when there's medical research there showing that, you know, you need these high doses of spray, like a spray. Epidelux is a spray as well, so it's going to work. It's going to get into the system quicker. So I really feel like there's a big body of work there to be done on the pharmacokinetics, you know, what different forms, and then we can actually start going into the more kind of quote unquote fun stuff where we're looking at these. If we are doing these kind of different muscle damage models, like there's a very good study done by Graham Close's group a couple of years ago where they did like simulated rugby match to try and induce muscle damage because we were saying these kind of drop jump models don't actually kind of do a good job at actually doing that. So I think that'd be kind of like step one, and then step two going into more of the fun stuff. I know the step one stuff is a bit boring, but it's probably necessary.
Yeah, spot on, mate. It's the same with like combat sports making weight. I feel like we kind of, everyone wants to do the step two, three, four studies and research, but we really need that step one stuff to know what we're doing and what we're looking for. But Mark, always a pleasure, mate. I won't take up any more of your time, but as always, I know we've said it twice before, but if guys want to reach out to you, they want to connect with you on social media, they want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, I suppose Instagram's probably best place. I'm mjermaine91, or just email me. So probably my most consistent email is my Gmail, because you might go from different universities. So I'm just like markjermaine91@gmail.com. So either of those deals, I'm pretty accessible. I reply to anyone and everyone when I can, and I'm try to be as prompt as possible as well. I don't like leaving people hanging on messages either. So if anyone does have any questions, I'm happy to follow up.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Mark. I know you're super busy, but I appreciate you taking the time. And everyone listening now, you know, that's where we're at with the science. That's where the research is at. I'm sure you're the same in Ireland and in the UK as we are in Aussie and New Zealand. I feel like every second athlete has a CBD sponsor. There's claims getting thrown out. And you know what? If there's no harm, there's nothing wrong with that per se. But I do think people need to be informed before you start throwing claims out at other people, pushing it on your teammates and whatnot. So, Mark, thank you for coming on. Thank you for clearing that up. And I really appreciate it.
No, appreciate being on. It's always a joy. Thank you.
All right, mate. We'll chat to you soon.
Chat out.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. CBD no doubt has massive potential in a number of different fields, not just in the sporting world, but with all of us regular folk as well. I'll be following this space closely and will be very interested to see what future research shows us in regards to the benefits of this exciting substance. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.